And when people were like, well, what's in Baltimore? Like, what's so cool about Baltimore? Okay, first of all, quoth the Raven, nevermore. Nevermore. I wasn't too much of a fan of Bela Lugosi as Dracula. I thought he was very goofy. And like, he's like, I don't drink wine. Just in case you're afraid of anything happening in the dark, guess what? There are such things. Hello, everyone. My name is Jason Ramirez, and welcome to another episode of the Hit List Podcast, a podcast where me and a guest cross off films from our watch list and discuss them. This is Season 6, Episode 6. And today I'm joined by a returning guest. He's a writer, he's a film noir enthusiast, and he's here back again to talk about horror. Welcome, everyone. Give a warm welcome to Alex Vlahov. Welcome, Alex. How are you?
Hey, Jason. I'm doing well. Thank you so much for having me back, man. I really appreciate it.
So before we get started, I have two questions for you. You know, I like to do these icebreakers.
Yeah.
First of all, how are you? What you been up to?
I'm good, thank you. I have my birthday in a couple days, so last week.
Oh, happy birthday.
Thanks, man. Yeah, so we've had some birthday celebrations. Saw a bunch of friends yesterday, and my girlfriend's birthday is kind of nearby as well. So I had a joint birthday going, lots of outings, and kind of celebrating this week. And yeah, probably going to go to Big Sur on Thursday, really beautiful part of California. And very excited about that, man. Yeah, that's pretty much what's happening over here. Staying busy day to day, and loving LA. How about you?
You know, I got a new job a couple months ago, so that's been doing pretty well for me. And yesterday, I did my first improv showcase, and I'd never done improv on stage before, so that was nerve-wracking, but also encouraging at the same time because I got a lot of laughs, and people liked me up there. So,
who are you doing it with? What school or theater are you doing it with?
So it's called the Baltimore Improv Group, and it's like its own theater in Baltimore.
Cool. And
yeah, I took a class. Like with every class, you have to do it. There's a showcase at the end. So like the last class is also the showcase. So yeah, you know, it was like, it's only like friends and family. So like it's the most encouraging audience you'll probably ever get in your life. So
improv's so fun. Love improv. I've done some UCB myself, but it's just great also just for practicing ease of, you know, conversation in any situation, you know, and it's as an art form, it's so impressive to watch. Big fan. They're very cool that you did that.
Yeah. Awesome. So I guess my second question for you is, I've noticed that you are a huge, not huge, but like you visit that, that place in LA a lot. What's it called? Like the telescope they go.
Yeah. I posted from there today, the observatory. Yeah. It's kind of a landmark. It is a landmark in the city, and it happens to be a short hike from my apartment, so it's a very easy way to stay fit and, you know, try to stay fit. And there's like this stairwell, specific stairwell called the Berendo Stairs, and then there's a couple after that, and then it just dumps you right into the park, and it does feel like nature. It does feel like, you know, you're in wild nature. Griffith Observatory is a really cool, beautiful building. It's like an odd combination of Art Deco with like Greek style. It's like an interesting clash. And a lot's filmed there. You as a, you know, film buff, you probably know Rebel Without a Cause, Devil in the Blue Dress, The Rocket Man, Terminator. A lot of things have been set there. The ending of Rebel Without a Cause is so, you know, notorious. That's why there's like a James Dean statue there. It's his bust, and it's a very creepy sculpture of his head. It has no eyes. So
really,
whenever you come to LA, I'll take you up there, and we'll go look at the eyeless James Dean statue at the Griffith Observatory.
So thing is, I've only been there once, and it was a few years ago. And I tried to go, but like the trip I was on, that same day I went, I was also leaving. So like I had to rush it. So I was like going there. Okay, sights. Okay, boom, boom, boom. Okay, let's go. So I didn't get to really fully immerse myself with the observatory. And the night before, I was going with someone and it was closed. I was like, oh, it closes at night? I mean, it makes sense, but still.
Yeah, it does have a couple evening hours. There are so many tour buses that come through. It was luckily really empty today, midday Monday, you know. So, that's a great thing to do when you visit. Whenever a lot of people come, I'll either show them that or I'll recommend that. You know, it's in Griffith Park is massive. There's the sign, there's the Country Cowboy Museum, the Autry. There's like flower gardens. Griffith Park is huge, so lots to see in there.
Gotcha. So let's get back on. Let's get into the discussion for today. We're actually going back to the old tradition of discussing two movies, but only because I want to discuss one movie. Today we'll be discussing Dracula and Dracula.
Excellent. Right. Very excited. I also just want to say that before we began, I mentioned that I was not a Dracula fan. I mean, I love Todd Browning and Freaks. It wasn't my Universal horror film. I'm like a Frankenstein Invisible Man guy. And then Dracula, I saw as a kid on VHS. And then we also would watch it when we go to vacationing in this little cabin town called Arnold. So I have like very strong memories of it early on, but I loved King Kong, Frankenstein, Invisible Man later. So rewatching it, it's so good. I don't know. I think it has a reputation of being a bit slow and plotty. Also, there's no music. You probably noticed. So I think it has a kind of a static reputation, but I had a really good time revisiting it. It's all about Bela Lugosi for me. So thanks for asking me to do this. It's an honor and very fun. Dracula is a 1931 American pre-code supernatural horror film directed and co-produced by Todd Browning, from a screenplay written by Garrett Fort, starring Bela Lugosi in the titular role. It is based on the 1924 stage play Dracula by Hamilton Dean and John L. Balderston, which in turn is adapted from the 1897 novel Dracula by Bram Stoker. Lugosi plays Count Dracula, a vampire who emigrates from Transylvania to England and preys upon the blood of living victims, including a young man's fiancée. The film was partially shot on sets at Universal Studios lot in California, which were reused at night for the filming of Dracula. A concurrently produced Spanish language version of the story, also by Universal. The Spanish version was on Jason's list. Jason, why was this on your list?
So, I had always known about Dracula. Like, I think we all know Dracula. He's like in the zeitgeist of culture, like just film and literature culture everywhere. And I'd always wanted to watch the old version. And I think a couple years ago, I was on Reddit and I learned about there was a Spanish version that was made at the same exact time. It is technically and visually looks better than the original because they are able to see the dailies that the English version shot and then just do improve upon those when they shot at night for the Spanish version. And I had never heard of a Spanish version of Dracula. I don't think most people have. And I think you, when I told you about it, I think you also didn't know about it either. Not a lot of people know about it. And it had to be preserved once it was found. So that's kind of why. I was just very curious as to like how was it better than the original. Because the original, like, I don't want to say original, but like the English version is like, it's like a part of our culture basically. So how was it better? So that was why it was on my list.
Excellent. Excellent. I did know about it only because BAM, the Brooklyn Academy of Music, did a curated series of Mexican horror films in 2015, 2016, I want to say. And this Dracula played then. I missed it, unfortunately, but I did get to see Santa Sangre, the Jodorowsky film, and a film that Guillermo del Toro really likes. It's maybe something involving I don't remember. It's like little girl. It's an evil little girl. There were some great films that played. I'll send you a list of those afterwards. But yeah, the BAM had this amazing Mexican horror series, and this was included. So, and I didn't see it for all these years. It was even on Criterion last year. Yeah, I missed it, and this was a great opportunity to catch up with it. Yeah, and that's a great technique that you have of having the guest sort of read the background and then ask the question. That's great structure. I just want to, yeah, really, really. For the listeners at home, Jason has a great handle on the flow of the convo. So it's you know, I love the behind the scenes podcast stuff. It's great. I feel very taken care of. It's great.
Yeah, I do my best. You know, it's only trial and error. You know, so I guess you kind of already went over what you thought, but like, what'd you think of like the both of them? As you say, you watched them both on the same day. So what'd you think as you were watching them?
Okay, I watched the Spanish one first because that was new. So unique and a little slower is the one thing. And I don't think that I liked their Dracula. I mean, Bela Lugosi is just so magnetic. Their Dracula was great. He actually reminded me of Timothy Carey, another old Hollywood actor who was also completely like nuts. He had a lot of stories about him off screen. But yeah, I really dug the different choices made. Things lingered longer. Like I loved it. Thank you so much for recommending this. Loved it. The biggest stark difference for me was the ending shot, right? I mean,
yes.
You notice that where you see Van Helsing looking down at Renfield, who, by the way, is also thrown from the stairs versus the tumble in the other one, right?
Mm-hmm.
In the Todd Browning version, the English version, he just tumbles down the stairs. The Spanish one, he just throws him over, and that's a steep fall. By the way, no banister on the staircase. Very, very dangerous, just in general, to like film, like do anything. So it's impressive that they, you know, used it and to such great effect. And the ship scene, I really preferred in the Spanish version.
Oh yeah, for sure.
So unique, screaming through the porthole, and the English one uses reused footage. I found out from a movie called The Stormbreaker. So like all the water spilling onto the deck, and it's kind of sped up. It's from an older film from 1920.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. That's recycled. Whereas in the Spanish one, you see Renfield laughing through the porthole. Very weird image. And then you do see Dracula and the reaction of a couple sailors, and it's great. It's very simple. Then, you know, they both have the steering wheel with the silhouette of the guy hanging. But no, to answer your question, I really enjoyed the Spanish version. I think it has a little bit of hype online of it's better than. Yeah. I think they're both great in different ways. I think that they both have drawbacks as well, you know? So, you know, I find the English one very mute and static because of there is such a lack of music. It does feel slow sometimes because of the silence and the pacing, and even more so in the Spanish one. But then there's interesting choices in the Spanish one. You know, I'm just so used to the Bela Lugosi one. It was great to see this. Like, it almost was like, you know, there was all this obsession with multiverse last year, right? Films in the multiverse. So it was like this, like parallel dimension version of Dracula. Really enjoyed seeing this for the first time.
I didn't think it was on purpose either. Like, it was completely by accident how a lot of movies, just in recent years, how many things are doing like multiverse. Like last year, we had Everything Everywhere All at Once, which was, you know, Academy Award winner of like almost every category. And then just recently we have Across the Spider-Verse, which is like a continuation of Into the Spider-Verse, where like many different versions of Spider-Man. And recently we had The Flash come out, which I don't want to talk too much about it, but like, even from the start, I was not a fan of like the way it was handled. I think most people aren't. I think that's why it's failing at the box office so bad. But anyway,
yeah, that's a really hard thing to navigate, where you can't really publicize or lean on your main guy or your main star. Exactly. But then you do have to reveal in the trailer what would have been an amazing surprise if they didn't put it in the trailers, which they had to. Because it's like, well, we need people to see it. So, but I don't know if their plan was, they might have pulled a No Way Home, right? Where they didn't reveal that, but things being what they were, they had to. And it's just kind of unfortunate all around.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just so much. That film has been plagued with like,
I haven't seen it. I didn't see it yet. I'm going.
Me neither. But like, I've been following the production for years, since like 2014 when Ezra Miller was first announced to be The Flash, like literally a week after the TV show was released, like the first episode. And so I've been seeing it basically like a, what's it called? Like a door, like a revolving door of like directors and writers going in and out of like that project across the years. And that was just with this iteration of The Flash.
Totally.
And yeah. So back to Dracula.
Happy. And also there was a Renfield movie this year. More relevant than ever. So
yeah, I haven't seen that one, but it's got Nicolas Cage as Dracula. So I might have to catch that one soon as well. So what I thought, well, because this was my first time watching Dracula in general. And I remember like last time we spoke after recording, I asked you about like recommendations and you recommended Frankenstein and Bride of Frankenstein, which I did like Bride of Frankenstein much more than the Frankenstein one. I just thought they could have been like edited together to like one more cohesive movie. It could have been like 1-2 hour movie, but I liked how it just improved a lot over the first one. And I saw The Mummy, didn't think too much about it. I think I told you that one. And it was October then, and I was going to watch Dracula, but I just didn't have time to watch it. So I was excited to watch it. And like you said, it's very mute and static, and I was not prepared for it. And you had to like remember to give it the context of like when the film was made.
Right.
It's like one the first talking horror movie. And you had to like learn that like they were so used to like silent films, especially Todd Browning, how he was a silent film director before this. So he wasn't used to using sound in his films. And there was also some philosophy of filmmaking where like they wouldn't use music unless there was music used in the scene. So like you could hear music during the opera or like the theater that they were in when Dracula's introducing himself to the people. But beyond that, you don't hear any music, where nowadays you would expect music or at least some sound design as well.
Right.
So I saw the Bela Lugosi one first because I was excited to see that one and just compare it against the Spanish version. I didn't know the Spanish version would be like a little longer, but I found both of them very slow. And I wasn't too fan of the slowness, but I love the set design. I love the acting, and I might be on the unpopular side, which I'm not unfamiliar with being unpopular, but I wasn't too much of a fan of Bela Lugosi as Dracula. I thought he was very goofy. And like, he's like, I don't drink wine.
Yeah, that line, it's very overplayed. It's very overplayed.
And there are a few other examples, but that's the one that stood out to me. I did like, I think his name's Carlos, the Spanish version Dracula, a little bit more than Bela Lugosi. And when I heard like it's better than like the English version, I felt like, oh, maybe it's like acting is different. Maybe the story's better. No, it's the same script.
The Spanish version does keep in some things where like, I even burn the letters, Renfield says. That's one difference. A detail I really like that I didn't catch in the English one. I mean, I might be wrong, but I'm pretty sure I only read that in the Spanish version.
And I think with the Spanish version, my family loves like the golden age of Mexican cinema. So like they have like channels specifically for that, like De Película. I think sure there are other ones, but that's the one that comes to mind where it's just like old Mexican black and white movies, and they love them. And just like seeing that just reminded me of that. I'm like, okay, I kind of have like some nostalgia towards like that type of film, that
have
type
you
of
heard
language.
Of the Witch's Mirror.
So.
That's a very El Espejo de la Bruja. That played in the BAM series. I need to find that. I've seen that. I was once at a Mexican bar that had like tacos and like it's like one in my hometown.
Yeah.
And on TV they had this like black and white horror film, and then I was able to look up based on the programming like what it was. It was this movie, and apparently it's like this like seminal. It's a landmark. I'm looking at it right now. It's a landmark film of Mexican horror genre. That's so cool that your parents had that on, kind of stuff on.
Yeah, but for them it's like not horror because they're Christian. They don't like horror movies. They like like dramas and romance.
Oh,
comedies.
Gotcha.
One big guy that my dad loves is comedy. So he loves Cantinflas. He loves Chespirito. Those guys, El Chavo, but.
Sábado Gigante, what is that? The
Sábado Gigante, yeah.
yeah.
Yeah, he used to watch that, but then he finally got too ridiculous later on. So
well, that went for like that. So long, right?
It was.
Like, I remember that as a kid. The guy with the tiny mustache and the freckles. Yeah. And Yeah.
So yeah. Overall for the film, like I liked it, but I did have some reservations. Like it's very slow at times, you know? Yeah, that's pretty much what I thought.
No, I hear you. And, you know, slight adjustment. Okay, I just found it. The films that I saw at BAM in this series called Holy Blood Mexican Horror Cinema was, I saw this film, Canoa, A Shameful Memory. That is like students slaughtered that stand up against a dictator. Poison for the Fairies. That's the one that Guillermo del Toro loves. It's two young girls. It's witchcraft. And then Alucarda. That's like a satanic one.
That sounds very familiar.
That one's huge. Very influential, apparently. And Santa Sangre. I didn't see Kronos. That also played.
Oh, yeah.
Witch's Mirror played. El Barón del Terror. The Curse of the Crying Woman. I didn't see these. And then La Tia Alejandra. But yeah, I'll send you this link of this lineup. But, you know, if people listening to this are interested in, like, Mexican horror films, hey, there's a couple, you know? I mean, but yeah, I definitely... that's Bela Lugosi is a little corny. I mean, especially it keeps cutting back to the eyes so many times, right? Just like, yeah.
I think that's what I liked more about the Spanish versions, because it wasn't like on the face. It was more focused on the eyes, and it had like, if I remember correctly, they had like a light on the eyes. So like it was like more like hypnotic in a way, whereas like in the English version, it's just like his face looking like this, just eyes wide and like a scowl. And then like, They're hypnotized. Like, what? Is this supposed to be a comedy? Is this why there were so many comedy like parodies of this movie? Or like...
And there are so many. I mean, Dracula, Dead and Loving It with Leslie Nielsen, right? And then there's the Mel Brooks one. And then I'm sure Abbott and Costello have met Dracula. I know they did the series of horror films, you know. Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein and all that. Bela Lugosi, kind of a sad... I'm sure you've seen Ed Wood, the Tim Burton film with Johnny Depp.
I'm familiar with it, but I don't know.
Like it's really good. Yeah. It's about the cult director Ed Wood from the 50s, who actually worked with a very elderly Bela Lugosi. I don't even know how elderly he was, because he was a morphine addict.
Really?
And in Tarantino's last book, his nonfiction book, Cinema Speculation. Great read, by the way, if you have a chance. He talks about this actor who's just like fantastic. He's in Bogdanovich film. Inside Daisy Miller. This guy also like wrote like for a horror film magazine in the 60s, maybe the 70s. And he wrote about Bela Lugosi. And Bela Lugosi's morphine addiction was like so bad. It like ruined his marriage late in life. She got him very clean and then left him. And then he only lived a couple more years. Yeah, after that. I passed the apartment he used to live at. It is like a very modest apartment. Very sad ending for kind of, you know, for one of the, you know, icons of... you know, just like a face people know in the horror genre, you know. Yeah. But Ed Wood is a really good representation. That actor, I'm forgetting his name right now, which is a bit embarrassing because I really like him. But I think he won an Oscar for that role. So he's in Crimes and Misdemeanors too. I'm forgetting his name. Yeah, please watch Ed Wood. If there's one recommendation that's Bela Lugosi related from our chat, a really fun film.
Okay. I'll definitely like keep that in mind. I think, wasn't he like the director that was like always like, considered like the worst director or whatever?
Tim Burton. Oh, Ed Wood. Horrible. Yeah. I mean, he's did some interesting things, Glenn or Glenda, but yeah, for the most part, his stuff is, it's, unless you watch it with like a curious or knowing eye, you know, if you were to just stumble into it, you might think it might be one of the worst things you've ever seen. Yeah. Plan 9 from Outer Space, I have seen. It's not, you know, it's actually kind of hard to get through. There are better bad films, you know what I mean, like, you know, more fun stuff to watch, but his life story is pretty interesting.
I guess we can talk about like the more technicalities of this film. So the main difference between both of them is the camera work and technicalities. So were there any moments in the film that you noticed were significantly different that you thought were not necessarily better, but like more interesting take that they did in the English, in the Spanish version?
Yeah, there's a moment with the succubi where the three women, the mistresses of Dracula, however you want to call them, kind of encroach on Renfield. And it just reminded me of, you know, the Macbeth, the three witches, or the three fates, you know, in Greek mythology, just these three figures. Whereas in the English one, like, you know, they all kind of come towards him. And then Dracula kind of stands up and bats them away. I really like the Spanish version's take on that scene. I think I mentioned the shipwreck. I think I mentioned the final shots, preferring the Spanish version. I like the mirror scene a lot in the Spanish version. The editing of that, it's great. Just kind of looking behind him. Yeah, it's very subtle. It's very, very obvious in the English one. He taps Jonathan Harkness, or in the Spanish one, Juan Harkness. You know, and I think it's Eva instead of Mina.
It's really funny because, like, I was thinking that, unfortunately, R. Kelly song, but, like, I'm thinking, like, the Weird Al version where he's like, and he looks at me, and I look at her, and he looks at me, and I look at her, and, like, just because of, like, the English version, it's like, okay, we get it. He's not visible in the mirror. Right. Like, they keep going with it. Like, you could have been a little bit more subtle. And then, I guess, like, the director for the Spanish version saw it. It's like, okay, we could be more subtle with it. And he was more subtle with it. And I'm very nitpicky in the sense, like, I noticed it immediately. Like, such as, like, that editing version. But also with the shipwreck, when, in the English version, when they transition into the ship, they do, like, and now they're traveling to England. You know, like, the letters on screen. Whereas in the Spanish version, it just cuts immediately to them on the ship, right? So there's no, like, transition sort of way. It just cuts to them on the ship. I'm like, okay, there we go. Modern editing, you know? So, yeah, that's, like, one major thing. And then there's also, like, when Dracula's first introduced in the English version, he's, like, you know, it's, like, a wide-angle establishing shot of him, like, coming down the stairs. Whereas in the Spanish version, it's like a tracking shot. The camera comes towards Dracula as up the stairs and introduces himself. Yes. That was a major difference.
The camera is almost like seduced by Dracula going towards
him. Right. That's a great way of saying it.
It's very static. The Todd Browning is very still camera. Which it works in a lot of cases because then there's a lot of negative space and darkness, and it really focuses the single. It's almost like an Edward Hopper painting where it's just like a person in a window or one figure. They're very lonely. There's something very lonely about it. Yeah. His work's really interesting. He did some silent films that I just really love. One of them is The Unholy Three with Lon Chaney. Sort of a circus related one. There's the best one is called The Unknown, which has Joan Crawford when she's like 19. It's like might be one of the first things she did, and she's with Lon Chaney, and he throws knives with his feet. What? And there's this ending where she's like on a spinning wheel and he's throwing knives at her. Todd Browning is so carnival circus influenced. Then he does Freaks, which is what he's very famous for. And Dracula, obviously. But yeah, I really love his work. I'm just, you know, kind of like looking at Letterboxd, some of the other things I've seen, like Mark of the Vampire, The Devil Doll. But yeah, I mean, if you really like his style at all, I would recommend The Unknown or Freaks is very famous because, you know, you could just never make a movie like that. That's pretty singular. Yeah, I mean, other differences. I do think that like this... There was a couple shots in the Spanish version that made me laugh on accident. Like it would cut to Van Helsing and he'd have such eyes wide. It was like so startling. And then also at one point I reached over for water, and because I know a little bit of Spanish, but not as much as, you know, I do need subtitles. And I heard the word, I kept hearing the word pesadilla. And the first time it was mentioned, I thought it was quesadilla. So I was like, what are they talking about? And then, okay, nightmare. Gotcha. It just because I looked away and I wasn't reading the subtitles. But
I get it.
That caught me off guard. But now I know how to say nightmare, which is great. You know, please name this episode Nightmare Quesadilla if you want.
That sounds excellent.
Well, watching these in one day was kind of like a Nightmare Quesadilla, you know, Dracula. But yeah, man. And then the final shot, like I said, just those differences. Oh, more music in the Spanish version. Whenever he rises from the coffin, plays his music. Yeah. And also, you don't even see that in the English version. You don't even see him rising. It's just the hands. And then
Yeah. That's what I thought was going to happen in the English version. Like, I thought that was like the iconic, like him rising from the coffin. But no, they don't even show that. It's just like a hand and then cut and he's already up out of the coffin, right?
Yeah.
And that's like a major difference where, like, in the Spanish version, it's like the same hand cut, you know, like hand. And then you see as the coffin opens, there's fog and there's light coming from the coffin. And then Dracula slowly rises from the coffin. And he's just like this ominous figure, like, oh, who is this guy? He's that guy. So that's what I really liked about it. Like, and I guess like some people took inspiration from that in like later films. I don't know where, but like I've seen that type of like move somewhere. But like, I guess it was inspired from this one specifically.
It also might be the, you know, Christopher Lee famously played Dracula in a ton of those Hammer horror. So there might be a specific shot where he just sits upright, you know. But I mean, it was also great to also just kind of brush up on my Spanish. I mean, like I took it in school and like, so I was able to like understand like a lot of words and I was like, oh yeah. So like, I mean, for anyone who is trying to remember it, like watching these two versions is actually like a really helpful way. I found it really, you know, I understood a lot more than I thought I would. So there was also that fun aspect of it too. I don't know if I prefer one more than the other. Because I watched them in the same day, I almost kind of like consider it one 1931 experience. I mean, shot in the day, shot in the night, same set. I mean, that's so rare. I know they did it for a couple other films too, but I don't know which ones. So
me neither. Yeah. It was a very short-lived experiment of like doing this because it was done before dubbing was really reliable.
Right.
And so that's something I learned when I was watching like the documentaries about Dracula, how they had like a huge Latin American market for like films and it was easy to translate them because you just had to like translate the words, right? But the scenes will stay the same, like the picture will stay the same. And then once it became like talking movies, they had to be like, oh, how are we gonna market this? So that was like one solution they came up with, like just film different versions of the same movie but with different actors in different languages. And this is one of the most popular ones that survived because it was the creators of the Spanish version took more creative liberty with it. And I don't think people really noticed at the time, or if they did, they probably didn't care.
Oh, well, I doubt. I, you know, studio oversight. I mean, the director didn't even speak Spanish.
He didn't, no.
He sounded like an interesting guy. George Medford. He's really famous for directing that Rudolph Valentino silent film, The Sheik. Because Rudolph Valentino died like super young. As I'm sure you know, he was like the first like teen idol, like dead early, you know, people were in love with him and mourning him. Like a James Dean, Heath Ledger legacy type thing, right? Rudolph Valentino was the first in the silent era. The Sheik was his biggest film. Same director as the Spanish Dracula. That's a huge silent film. And he liked being in entertainment so much that eventually he kind of stopped directing but would continue acting in films. So he was in a couple Preston Sturges films. And, you know, Preston Sturges has done like Sullivan's Travels and so many great sort of screwball comedies. So I wonder which ones George Medford's been in. I need to go back and see. Just interesting career for this guy.
So I feel like we kind of like talked enough about like what we thought about the film. Unless there's like any final thoughts before I go into the production of the film, like what went into it.
I'm looking at this to see if the shots of the lady in white walking in the darkness in the Spanish version is so good. That is, I think, what I had about the version. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure we're going through my notes here. That's most of what I thought about the film. A lot of, I find what interesting is around the film that it was like kind of hard to see for so long. It was in Cuba, and also a lot of people have different dialects in this film, so it's like different clashes, different versions of Spanish. a part of it was missing. It was released in VHS in 1992. It was kind of not really available for most of the 20th century. But I'm just very glad it's been reclaimed. Oh, one thing I do want to mention. Carla Laemmle. There's two people.
Oh, yeah.
She's in both. She's the only person in both. There's an actor.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. There is an actor who is, I believe, a little person. He says Nosferatu, the Spanish version. He's in the English one, too. But someone who, like, has a lot of dialogue in both is, she's the in the stagecoach at the beginning, reading the facts of the glasses. That's Carla Laemmle. She lived to be, like, over 100 years old. And she's the only person that really has, like, you know, she's seated, I think, closer to the camera in the Spanish version in the beginning stagecoach. She's deaf. I remembered her from the English one, related to, you know, Carl Laemmle, you know, who was, you know, a major producer at the time. So, you know, that's just a fun connection.
And something I learned about her is that she, her opening line, she's the first person, like, to speak the first lines in a talking horror movie. Like,
wow.
First person ever. I'm like, yo, that is really cool to see, like, to even know about that fact. She's the first person to ever speak lines in a horror movie.
Love that. I love, it's like the first zombie in the Night of the Living Dead. That one guy, he got famous. He would go to Comic Cons later. But yeah, that one guy, that's him in the black and white. That one tall guy.
Yeah. So actually, there are a couple things. I did write some notes I thought was really funny. I thought, like, there was some great use of shadows. And I don't remember in which context it was, but I do remember, like, enough that, like, I wrote that down as a note. And what was it? I said, it makes much more sense that Dracula seduces the maid to move the Wolfsbane. I guess because I was confused as to, like, how the Wolfsbane was moved in the English version, that somehow it made more sense in the Spanish version. But I also wrote, damn, maybe it looks kind of sexy. I'm like, okay, Jason.
Well, she that actress, she's great.
Yeah, she was really good.
She's fantastic. I just want to bring up her name. She is in the first Spanish speaking non-silent film, Lupita Tovar.
Lupita.
She also lived up to 2016, long time. She's in Santa, which is one of the first Mexican sound films.
Okay.
Lupita Tovar. She very prolific, worked a lot in a couple major films, Santa, Dracula, and lived a long time. So
and also, like, the way they use the catacombs in the final scenes in the Spanish version, it just looked like better framing. They used, like, a doorway to, like, frame a shot that I really liked. That was a great use of, like, what they had. And that final shot, that was my favorite shot in the whole film, because it was like Van Helsing looking down at Renfield, and then John and Ava just going up towards the light. It kind of, like, signifying, like, they're going up to like, heaven. Not heaven, necessarily, like, to the good side. Like, they're leaving the evil.
There's, like, and wedding chimes that play, kind of.
Yeah.
Like bells. Yeah.
So, I really like that. That could be, like, a screenshot. Like, that could be, like, a wallpaper I could like, frame, like, right here. So, that was, like, one of my favorite shots in the whole film.
Completely agree, man. That shot really... that's when I was, like, okay, now I get why people... you know, opine that the Spanish version is better, because that final shot really is very powerful. It's such an interesting balance of survival and then Renfield and a corpse, you know, and Van Helsing just has blood on his hands. He just stabbed a vampire to death. So
yeah.
Good balance. The English one, it just shows them descending. It ends so abruptly. It's almost like a Hitchcock film. It just ends, you know, it's like done, we're done.
Yeah,
but like I said, I love throwing Renfield over the stairs versus, because that's brutal. That's like a stone floor. Did you notice the armadillos?
Yeah, I did notice the armadillos. They were very weird. I don't know why they're armadillos in, what was it, London, England?
Yeah, well, they're in the castle, and it goes back to, like, an urban legend, or I guess folklore myth. I don't really know how to classify it. Misinformation, where armadillos would bite into wooden coffins and graves and eat corpses. So
really?
There was some association at the time, so it might have made sense to audiences then. But to us, it's just like, oh, that's weird. There's a possum and armadillos and a bug with its own coffin. So, yeah. I mean, the rats are great. That makes sense. That's what you expect. I mean,
right.
Renfield makes a huge deal of the rats and the bugs.
Ratas. Ratas.
He was great. A little overacting, but he was great. I both Renfields. That's, you know, that's a big, big role. Like, you know, you start off small and then you go just to 100, you know?
Right. And now a quick break. And then when we come back, we can talk about the production. Now back to the show. We're here talking about the production of technically both of these films, because you can't talk about one without the other. So I said this earlier, where in the late 1920s, Hollywood studios depended on like the successful exportation of their films, because it was easy to export silent films, just rewrite it in like Spanish or whatever. It was the development of sound film that they realized we have kind of have a problem, like how are we going to export this? So they decided to do what they do here, like just use the same script, use the same set, just have different actors from different languages do these roles. So there were like other versions of this film. There was a French version, there was a German version, and then right here we have the Spanish version of this film. So this was directed by George Melford. He was hired to direct with actors Lupita Tovar and Carlos Villarias. And Melford, like you said, he was an actor who made several directorial credits, including the Ruda Valentino film, The Sheik. So you basically saying all the stuff I was going to say.
Oh, yeah, I know like that it. One. I think East of Borneo is the only one that I might have heard of his other work. He also did a couple other Spanish Universal films.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah,
he handled all the Spanish versions, even though he didn't speak Spanish, which I find very funny.
Yeah.
So October 10th, he began directing the film, shooting at night while Browning's crew would, Todd Browning being the director for the English version, he would shoot during the day. So at certain times, they'll shoot on the same set. And the filming lasted a total of 22 shooting days. So far, they made it for as little money as possible, in her opinion. And I'm sure it was true, because, you know, it's if you're going to do different language versions of the same movie, you're going to spread your money a little thin. Also, this film is a half hour longer than Browning's version.
Right.
And the costumes are different, as noted by Lupita Tovar. She said they were more like low cut, more revealing in a Spanish version, whereas in the English version, it's more covered up.
You definitely notice that. There's a sensuality to her dress. I know King Kong has come up. It did remind me a bit of Fay Wray, her dress, the white low cut gown. It's much more, revealing than Mina Harker in the Browning version.
David J. Skull, he's a film historian. In his book called Hollywood Gothic, which came out in 1990, it included footage taken from a print of the film archived in the Cinemateca de Cuba, which included footage missing from the Library of Congress that the copy was screened in. And he concluded that the film was superior to Browning's version. So that's kind of like where where the discussion began, where like he was like one of the first people to like discuss like both of them in print. And like the reception, you know, it's like a lot of good reception towards like composition and camera movement. It gives it more fluid, more sinister mood, as some critics, like such as Mark Deming of All Moving.
It is definitely is more fluid. Yeah.
Yeah. In my opinion, I do like it better, but like it's still the same script. I still find it slow, but that's what I had here. And as far as like influences on other notable Draculas, this is both Bela Lugosi and Carlos Villarias. Christopher Lee, who played Dracula in the Hammer series, had this to say about Lugosi's Dracula. Anyhow, about the Lugosi Dracula, I was so disappointed. I had absolutely had been wanting to see it for a long, long time. There are aspects of it, for instance, that I considered ridiculous. Dracula is played too nice at the beginning, practically no menace in the character. There's no shock or fright in it. Lugosi stands too... He held them out stiffly, making him look like a puppet. His smell was not always sinister either. And that's the end of the quote. And I felt the same about it. I'm very glad that like one of my favorite Draculas shares my opinion about like a notable Dracula. But Gary Oldman.
He's a little stiff for sure. Oh, Gary Oldman played him. Yeah, that's right.
Gary Oldman played Dracula in Francis Ford Coppola's adaptation. And he considered Lugosi to be his favorite Dracula. And instead of his performance, he was really onto something. The way he moved, the way he sounded. And Gary based his Dracula's voice on Lugosi's voice.
And I like that version. I do like that version with Tom Waits as Renfield. That's a fun one.
I basically borrowed a Dracula DVD from the library, and in it there were like a lot of special features, including the Spanish version of Dracula.
Oh, great. And that's great that they included it on there.
In the Spanish version, there's an introduction by Lupita Tovar. She's like an older lady at that moment. She's like She's a senior citizen at that moment, and she introduces the film in Spanish, and she said both Draculas were similar, even though they didn't talk to each other about how they're going to do Dracula. They just somehow ended up doing the same thing, but like the way they held out their fingers were different, but like basically kind of like similar in a way. And they actually believed that Pablo Alvarez Rubio, who played Renfield in the Spanish version, they thought he was actually going crazy because he did it so well, and he would practice by himself. he rehearsed by himself, wow. And they never needed to do a second take with him because he did it that well.
If he's rehearsing on his own, then I'd imagine it's in the middle of the night, people are tired, he's just talking to himself in the corner. Yeah, I could understand why people might think there's something wrong.
Yeah, and I also saw it's a documentary called The Road to Dracula, where Carla Laimly, she's the host of the film. She's introducing it. And there are a lot of notable people, like such as David Scull, who I mentioned, he's in this movie, discussing Dracula. And she received fan mail for her role in Dracula.
Wow.
Like, even though she's only there for like a moment.
Brief, yeah. I
mentioned this earlier a bit. David Scull said this, and that's why I said it, because I agree with him. He said, Dracula is quite simply the most media-friendly fictional personality of the 20th century, if not all time.
Hmm.
Even people who've never read the book or seen the movie will still know exactly who he is.
It's very true. Nosferatu, I think, is one of the, you know, big early ones. And,
yeah.
Stoker estate, from what I remember, Bram Stoker, you know, his family wanted all copies destroyed of Nosferatu.
Yeah.
Because it's just a ripoff of the Dracula story. So here's my theory, is that like there's so much in arts and literature and history about sex and death combined. And the mm-hmm. idea that like there's this one figure that is very seductive and can kill you, but also give you eternal life, is it upsets domesticity in a very alarming way that I think has, you know, intrigued readers, viewers for, you know, well over a century now. You know, the idea that he can literally bite men, women. He's this very alluring, socially pleasant, mysterious figure. It upsets sort of the normalcy that's established. It's this weird package of sex and death. And, you know, you look at La Petite Mort in France, that's the, you know, the word, right? I mean, and then it's all over Shakespeare and Jacobean plays, and, you know, it pops up vampires, you know, even the Twilight films, and it's all just part of it. It's a strong vein in the literary tradition. So, yeah, there's something, you know, it's like a Superman figure someone like that. It's just a perennial, strong societal, cultural recognizable, I mean, you know, a vampire, usually Dracula, you know, it's going to come up every year. There's going to be a new version, you know, they're, like I mentioned, Renfield this year, you know?
Yeah, definitely. And the thing is, like, the him being like seductive and attractive is very, it's what started in this movie, in Dracula, 1931, because in the book, I'm not sure if you've read the book, but I listened to the audiobook by Christopher Lee,
by the way. Awesome. Yeah.
And he's supposed to be ugly, you know? He's not supposed to be, like, attractive at all. It was just something that they made for the movies. And I guess, like, they kind of just went with it, and it became his own thing where, like you said, like, it's synonymous with, like, sex and death and all that. So I guess it became a thing of its own, if that makes sense.
Yeah, Gary Oldman, I guess that makes sense why his is so grotesque, because it is closer to the novel. I read about half of the novel. Oh, in middle school too, which I probably didn't even understand most of what I was reading, but I liked it.
About like the production of this film. So Carl Laimly, he was hesitant to make horror films despite the success of The Hunchback of Notre Dame and The Phantom of the Opera. And it was his son, Carl Laimly Jr., who really wanted to produce Dracula. He grew up watching these movies from Universal, and he just loved the macabre. He's what you would call a goth kid, you know? And he wanted Shaney, who played the Hunchback, to play Dracula, and he would have been a very different take on it for sure, but he died shortly before he would be able to play him, so they had to go with finding someone else to play him. And Bela Lugosi seriously fought to play this role. We mentioned like how it's static and mute, Todd Browning's version, the English version. It's because Todd Browning had trouble adapting to sound film, and there are long sequences where there's no sound. It's just silent. And people have speculated it might have been because he was too frightened by the mechanics of the sound equipment to use it. So that's one theory as to like why it wasn't not a lot of sound design in the film.
Right, right. Yeah, and, that totally makes sense.
And it was originally going to be planned to be like a lavish, like big budget production based more on the novel. Unfortunately, there was something called the 1929 stock market crash and the Great Depression that stopped them from doing that. So they had to cut back significantly and ended up basing the film based largely on the stage play. And it's shocking to me now because I find him goofy, but people were actually really frightened by Dracula when it came out. They were actually scared of him.
Not only frightened, but also there was this reputation of Bela Lugosi being this exotic lover from a distant land. I mean, it's like, that guy was making... I'm sorry. Like, you know what I mean? It's he certainly casts a certain allure. I mean, you know, it's 1931. I'm sure people have never seen someone like this before. It's just so funny. Yeah, people were scared of him and attracted to him. And now it's kind of... it's also just so culturally worn. It is cool to hear him say the famous lines, you know, I am Dracula, you know. It's fun to revisit that. But it doesn't come across as scary. Invisible Man comes across as scary. He derails a train. Mm-hmm. He kills hundreds of people. You know, that's... Frankenstein once in a while comes across as scary. I would agree about The Mummy. Didn't love The Mummy. Mm-hmm. I do like those two silent ones that you mentioned, Hunchback and Phantom of the Opera. That famous taking the mask off scene is still very, very effective.
What I find very funny about the Spanish version is that like Carl Laemmle Jr., he was very ambitious about producing the Spanish version, particularly because he had feelings towards the leading lady, Lupita Tovar. And I think they actually got married a couple years later after this production. Like, he's like, no, I have to work on this film. I have to work on this film. So that's why he was very for the production of the Spanish version, because he really wanted to like get closer to her.
And interesting.
It's really like these relationships that happen on set.
The other marriage that I found interesting at this time, George Medford, the Spanish director's wife in life before this film, he was married to a woman named Diana Miller, who she wasn't in very much, but she I think worked for a bit for Lasky, which became Paramount, and then went to Fox. She married George Medford and died at 25. I think she was in a sanatorium. I never know how to pronounce that. She had a pulmonary hemorrhage, so it was something natural. But she had a pretty rough life. Was struggled for a bit there. But just one of those like silent film stars that had died in their mid-20s, had a really short life and kind of rough. But yeah, the director had been married to her. So her name came up as I was reading about these people. Just wanted to flag. Oh, this guy also directed The Roundup, which is a Fatty Arbuckle Western that's very fun. And that's shot in Lone Pine, which is an amazing California location. A bunch of Westerns are filmed out there. I visited. It's a really cool, there's like unique rock formations. Tons of films have shot out there. So if you're ever in California, Lone Pine, I cannot recommend it enough. Very cool little spot.
Gotcha. I'll keep that in mind. And like the final effects right here, because I found them, it was a fitting way to end the documentary. I guess fitting way to like close out the discussion of like the production of the film. So Lugosi was pretty much typecast after Dracula. And he said in interviews that the role is like both a blessing and a curse, because it gave him so much success, but also typecast him into like basically the same role for movies after that. And what I found very cool was that he was buried with one of the capes from the production.
Oh, that's awesome. That's so funny. He's in Culver City. He's buried in LA. That's really, really funny. I think it's Holy Cross, I think it's called. I could be wrong. It has a very sort of, you know, not a huge, you know, very kind of straightforward name. But one Halloween I actually visited because I was in the area, and people leave little bats and little fake teeth and stuff. Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, in Baltimore, because Edgar Allan Poe is from Baltimore.
Oh, yeah, he's like the patron saint.
Yeah, and there was a few years ago, there was like this speculation, like this person would like mysteriously visit him on his like his death, like the day he died, and like would leave like a rose there.
Mm-hmm.
And people didn't know who he was or whatever, and every year they kind of just expect people like go there and just speculate as he did it. I read about that when I was in middle school, so I don't know if it's still done or if it became like more of a tradition among people in Baltimore, but that's just what it reminds me of. And when people were like, well, what's in Baltimore, like what's so cool about Baltimore? Okay, first of all, quoth the Raven, nevermore. Nevermore. Don't make me like wall you up in like in a corner in the basement or something.
Cask of Amontillado. Yeah.
Yeah, got, exactly.
And John Waters. You got John Waters too.
And John Waters. And yeah. I really want to meet him. Like, I think it's possible for me to meet him because one of my professors is pretty close with him. Not close with him, but like they know each other. So
I love his
I
work.
Do want to meet him.
I love his work. I love all the Poe Baltimore stories. Yeah, he really cuts a large shadow in Baltimore history. yeah, you know, the marrying his, like, you know, in, you know, teenage cousin stuff is weird, but
yeah, that's weird.
Mysterious death too, from what I understand. I've heard about the rose. I think it's like a champagne. Do they leave champagne as well?
I think something like toast? That. It's very.
It's and it was going on for like a long time, so they think that it's like the baton has been passed for the person. That,
yeah.
I remember reading about that too, man. I definitely. It's weird those famous graves that are visited. I did visit the Jim Morrison one in Paris. That's a very famous one. People do visit that one. Oscar Wilde is in the same cemetery. I just happened to be in the traveling, and yeah, I saw that one. And then there's all these lipstick marks all over it. So I guess it's like a tradition to kiss that one. So yeah, it's just funny, these traditions, you know.
So one last fact to close it out, because this is how they actually closed some of the screenings for Dracula. When the film was first released, it was accompanied by a final speech from the Van Helsing character, not the actor, the character. Where he says that when you go home and are afraid to see a face behind a window, when you turn on the lights, guess what? There are such things. Like he said, it's such a, there are such things.
Interesting.
And that's how they fit.
Huh. Well, because the Frankenstein begins with what you are about to see is a diabolical, there's some sort of presentational quality to that film. And it's the same year too, so it makes sense that they would do that. I guess that was kind of in fashion at the time.
Yeah, and it's like one of the first movies that like didn't have like a explanation behind it. I guess I thought that was pretty cool, like pretty funny and goofy, like, hey, just in case you're afraid of anything happening in the dark, guess what, there are such things.
I mean, the vampire, there's been concepts going back in so many different cultures. In Slavic history, there's a word for it. You know, my dad's from Croatia, so there's like the Wordalok, famous Wordalok is like the Slavic folklore version of the vampire. And then you know, you look at other cultures, they have their own versions of sort of blood sucking entities. It's a very common fear. I really think it just comes from our, you know, primate fear of snakes, and you know, actual, you know, interacting with bugs and reptiles, and a different time for the human species, you know, recognizing that a bite in the blood is bad, and the idea of like a human that does that is crazy, right? But it plays on a very, very primal fear that we're probably not really cognizant of. I'm just sort of like looking at my notes, the only other thing I really had here was when Mina is saying in the English one, I love the fog, I love the night, and then she's talking to the bat while Jonathan's like, what do you mean, on the balcony? That is when, as a kid, I remember seeing in the woods in Arnold, and Arnold's a very, like, you know, it's very remote at night, it's very, you know, it's the woods, it's creepy, right? So that actually kind of freaked me out a little bit. And I do remember clocking that scene as a kid, and seeing it again, it was like an unlocked memory, you know,
right?
So that was really cool to revisit. Yeah. I've seen, this is probably the fourth time or fifth time I've seen it in my life. Funny to think that those hills and both are just the Universal backlot, which is like 15 minutes from my apartment. Like, you do the studio tour, like, you probably see those hills, exactly those. The bat is hilarious. It's still funny. It's so cheap. It's so cheap. Yeah, I that was about it in terms of notes that I had taken. The fun little Hamlet reference, words in the English version. Yeah, I mean, yeah, this has been really, really fun, sort of like going back and looking at these and comparing them. Especially, I it was almost like a film class, like watching them in one right. day. One day is a really, really interesting way. You know, you learn a lot, you glean. It's like watching the, you know, the Alfred Hitchcock Psycho and then the Gus Van Sant Psycho, I guess, in the same day, you know? You know, you really do, you almost make your own informed choices of, here's how, you know, I might approach this, you know, or here's how another might approach this, right? Like, very hands-on way to see a production kind of unspooled back-to-back. So, yeah, thanks for asking me on to talk about these. I really, really enjoyed watching both of these.
Yeah, so with that, that concludes our conversation today. I want to thank you, Alex, for being on this podcast. I always enjoy it when we talk about films.
I always enjoy it too, man. Jason, you're an absolute pleasure to talk to. Yeah, thank you so much for asking me back, and glad you got to check this off the list.
So my question for you is, was Dracula a hit or a miss with you?
The Spanish version or the English version?
Yes.
combined, I'm going to say hit. I'm going to say hit. If taking both into account, yeah.
Yeah, I would have to say that as well. Even though I found it slow, I don't think it was a bad film, either of them, and I liked their different takes on it. It's like having like the same base story, same base set, but taking different directions with it and seeing like the creativity that can come from based on different visions, you know? So where can we find you on social media?
Only Film Noir. That's where I am on Instagram. Might be doing TikToks soon or doing more film history stuff on TikTok. Not really doing that right now. But yeah, and also Alex Vlado, I'm just also available there. Feel free to reach out, always say hi. And you know, I pop up on a couple other podcasts too. Feel free to listen to those if you like noir history to talk about. And some horror, I've talked about some horror noir. This is the really the first time I've talked, you know, straight horror. And very specifically, universal horror, classic black and white horror. So, you know, it's very much up my alley.
Awesome. So that's it for today, folks. Thank you for listening to another episode of the Hit List Podcast. This was season 6, episode 6. My name is Jason, and until next time, cross off a new film from your list.